Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona, I'm looking at today's title, Renouncing American Citizenship Hits an All-Time Record. Is that right? Is that what's happening?
Well, it does sound odd, Mark, doesn't it? Because for the past 8 years, I think Investment Voice has primarily focused on inbound immigration. We've had a modicum of episodes on global immigration, which has increased. Mm-hmm. And it does seem a bizarre concept that a person would want to give up what's really considered one of the most coveted passports in the world. But there are statistics out there showing that there really is a growing number of people wanting to give up their U.S. passports. I mean, we ourselves are seeing it from a number of our clients. I'll explain later. But what does it really mean? Well, to give up your passport really means that under the Immigration and Nationality Act, which is the act which really covers most of immigration in the U.S., mm-hmm. a U.S. citizen does have the right to renounce his or her citizenship by voluntarily making a formal renunciation in front of a consular officer or a diplomat, and they sign it. Giving up U.S. citizenship means giving up all your benefits, such as voting rights, government protection. If you're abroad, don't walk around North Korea if you're going to give up your U.S. citizenship. citizenship for children born outside of the U.S. And of course, renunciation involves a lengthy process and extensive paperwork. It's not an easy process. You really need to talk to someone who knows what they're doing.
And that's why on today's episode, we have Alexander Marino. Alex has years of experience in cross-border tax law, estate planning, corporate tax, and U.S. expatriation law. In addition to leading the U.S. tax practice group at Moody's Tax Law, Alex also heads the U.S. renunciation practice, annually representing hundreds of clients worldwide in properly giving up their U.S. citizenship or terminating their U.S. green card status. Alex, welcome to the show.
Oh, perfect. Thanks for having me.
Alex, you're very used to speaking about this topic, right?
Yeah, fortunately, you know, here at Moody's, we help anywhere from about 900 to 1,200 people a year properly give up their U.S. citizenship or green card status, and have been doing it since 2011, 2012, when we first saw what used to be a trickle of individuals looking to hand in, as you mentioned earlier, one of the most coveted passports in the world, which fast forward to 2024 is a bit of a flood of individuals looking to turn in one of the most coveted passports in the world. And of course, it's because of that taxation treatment of being an expat abroad.
It isn't just that, because in putting this podcast outline together, I did do a lot of research and we came across other reasons other than taxes. And I'm sure you've also heard of it. And some of the reasons seem to be a little emotional to me, which seems a little, I don't know, is a little far-fetched, but why are you seeing that there is a rise in the increased number of people who want to renounce citizenship?
Yeah, one of the larger reasons, and you're absolutely right, there is an emotional component that goes into the decision of either keeping or giving up your U.S. citizenship. And you got to remember, anybody who's giving up their U.S. citizenship is living outside or will be living outside the United States. So people aren't excited about giving up one of the most coveted, powerful passports in the world, paying lawyers, paying accountants, paying a government fee, going before a consulate officer at an embassy or consulate outside the U.S. for an interview between bulletproof glass, approval by the U.S. Attorney General, avoidance of the exit tax, not being blacklisted for life. It's not a fun process. But why are people doing it? They're doing it because the United States is one of two countries in the world that taxes on citizenship, which means no matter where you go, every dollar, euro, peso, pound is going to be subject to tax in life and subject to a U.S. estate tax in death. And for many individuals, either living in a jurisdiction that also taxes the individual because they're a resident there, whether it be Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, Italy, Germany, and then also paying tax to a country you no longer live in because they tax on citizenship, or what's the point of moving to a low tax jurisdiction like Singapore, like UAE, like Saudi, to pay a 0% tax, to only have to pay Uncle Sam his 25 to 40%.
But before we get into the taxes, Alex, for reasons for the increased number of people renouncing citizenship, I came across the fact that there's been a rise in nomadic lifestyles. Yeah. I personally know a number of people who are U.S. citizens and they just don't want to live in the U.S. anymore. They are living overseas because of the rise in being able to do so. And that's a post-COVID issue.
Oh, absolutely. And we see a lot of those clients who are making that decision. So really, there's a couple subcategories of people looking at renouncing. Number one, you've got the individual who's has a fallback passport living in a high-tax jurisdiction. You've got the other individual who may be leaving the U.S. and moving to a low-tax jurisdiction and going to purchase another citizenship to fall back on in getting rid of the U.S. Or you can have, you know, a combination of the two in reference to, as you mentioned, the nomadic person who's going to say, hey, I'm not going to be a tax resident anywhere. I'm going to, you know, sort of ping pong across the globe, not fall into the tax residency pitfall in any country, but again, absolutely able to do that and still be American. But the wealth savings, both from compliance costs, double tax, headache, succession planning, if you can properly get rid of the U.S. when either living abroad in one jurisdiction, nomadically in multiple jurisdictions, in a high tax or low tax part of the world, I always say being taxed by one country or zero countries is a whole lot better than being taxed by two. And you will always have Uncle Sam in your pocket to the day you die, no matter where you are, if you're American.
Well, I'm going to get into that. Let's pick up on the issue of dual citizenship for a second. Mm-hmm. There are a number of countries which do not allow dual citizenship. I'm a dual citizen myself of the United Kingdom and the United States. Living in the US, I don't pay taxes, UK taxes. But if I go and live in the UK, then I do believe I'm going to be paying UK taxes and US taxes.
That's correct. You're absolutely right. To your first point, there are some countries that don't allow dual citizenship, and we help those individuals mandatorily renounce. So if you want to naturalize into your Japanese citizenship or Singaporean citizenship or Saudi or German citizenship, although the Germans may be shifting here very shortly, you have to give up all the others. Those countries say you have to pick a team if you want to become one of us, great, but you got to get rid of the rest. So you have to renounce, and you have to renounce properly. To your other point, which is your example, you're absolutely correct. Every other first, second, third world country other than the US, and if you're ever on Jeopardy, the other country that taxes on citizenship is Eritrea. It's a small East African country.
Good to know.
Yeah, and now I'm waiting for that to come up in Jeopardy.
But to your specific situation, Mona, you're absolutely correct. The United Kingdom and their tax jurisdiction, which is the HMRC, like 99% of the world, taxes on residency. So if you go into the United Kingdom and become a resident, they tax your worldwide assets. When you're not living in the UK, they don't tax you. So while you're a UK citizen living in the US, only one country is taxing you. That's the US, because you live there. If you were to leave and say, you know what, it's been fun, US, I'm going to go live in the UK. Well, now the HMRC is going to tax you on everything you earn in life and in death, and they have a nasty inheritance tax. And the U.S. is going to say, great, you left the United States, but you're still a citizen, and we tax you the same way, whether you're living in Manhattan or you've never stepped foot on U.S. soil your entire life if you're a U.S. citizen. And now you have two jurisdictions taxing you, and they don't always match up. This is where you have to file in two countries, pay double tax. One of the most famous Brits who got stung with this is, you know, your former prime minister, Boris Johnson.
Yes, he was born in the U.S. No, people don't realize that.
That's right. Boris was born in New York, left at age four. He was famous for selling his London flat for a large gain, capital gain. Sale of your home is tax-free in just about every other country but the U.S., including the U.K. HMRC saying, congratulations, you don't owe us anything. Uncle Sam said, hey, you're still a U.S. citizen, and we tax you on your worldwide assets no matter where you are in the world, and we want what turned out to be hundreds of thousands of pounds in tax on the sale of his home. And when he was asked, you know, the media picked up on it and said, you're going to pay your bill? He told them no. And when you tell the U.S. government you're not going to pay them, that doesn't end well for you. And it didn't end well for Boris.
Could you tell us what Boris should have done?
Boris ended up having to pay. What he should have done is properly renounce, then sell his house, and he'd be hundreds of thousands of pounds richer. What Boris did is he sold the house, then he renounced.
So let me ask you, what if I just don't report it? I mean, how would the U.S. government know?
Yeah, that's the issue. The issue is, and we can thank some of our most recent administrations for putting the U.S. expat like yourself, of course, if you were to move to the U.K. in your example, Mona, putting them in a little bit of a vice, because U.S. citizen-based taxation is nothing new. This isn't a law that was passed. This has been around since the War of 1812. So we've got two centuries under our belt of the U.S. taxing on citizenship. What changed is what's called FATCA, the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act.
Oh, that was the gift from Obama, right?
That was the gift from Obama. Yeah, in 2010.
Much as I love Obama.
Exactly. Many expats have a very favorable view of Obama, but this is one where they feel they got thrown under the bus.
Yeah.
Because what FATCA says is it says, dear countries of the world, the U.S. has passed a law that says all of your banks and financial institutions abroad have to find out if you're a U.S. citizen depositor, and they have to turn over your name, address, financial information to us, and now we know where to tax you.
Are there stiff penalties if you do willful non-reporting?
For U.S. citizens living abroad or U.S. citizens, period, who have not been filing their U.S. tax returns, and for many, when you're living in a high-tax jurisdiction that has a tax treaty, there is a higher percentage that when you file these U.S. returns, you won't owe them tax. Now, not always, believe me. This is why we have year-long wait times to renounce in many jurisdictions. But you hit the nail right on the head, Mona, in the fact that if the IRS catches you before you can go to them under an amnesty program, even if you owe them no tax, not filing their forms, not filing the return, not filing the FBAR, the 8938, all these different reporting forms each year that an expat needs to file because they have assets outside the U.S. can result in tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, in penalties, which is oftentimes more difficult to deal with than the tax owing itself.
Oh, wow. So let me give you another situation, Alex. We have a number of clients who want to get the green card for their family. And the way it works with the EB-5 program, if one family can come in with as many children as they'd like, as long as they're under 21. So often the parents who might be wealthy, they live in Singapore or they live in the UAE or somewhere, and they're used to having all this tax-free income. They have three or four children. They're all under 21. They file. The mother might get the green card or the father, and the children all get it. Now, as the children get older, the mother and father say, well, we don't want to live in the US. We want to go back to Singapore or the UAE. And they do, but they don't do anything about their green card. Are they still covered under this? Or because they're not US citizens and they're only green card holders, are they exempt?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And unfortunately, Mona, for the people in your green card group, U.S. citizens and green card holders. So I help run the largest expatriation practice group in the world. I've renounced and terminated more than 5,400 green cards and citizenships on six different continents. You'll read in the code that green card holders, and by code, I mean internal revenue code, green card holders are taxed the same way.
Oh, wow.
So this is why when you run an expatriation practice group, people go, what the hell does expatriation mean? I want to learn about renouncing U.S. citizenship. Expatriation is broken up into those looking to renounce their citizenship properly or terminate their green card properly, because both are taxed the same way. Now, a work permit, a visa, those don't. If you leave, they leave with you. It's the green card holders, it's the citizens. So you bring up a really good point. In the old days, and by old days, I mean before Barack Obama passed FATCA in 2010, it was sexy business for a lot of our Asian and Middle East clients to spend a lot of money to have their children and grandchildren born in Florida or California to be U.S.
Yeah.
Now they regret that. And the same thing with the green card. You say, hey, I'm going to get you a gift. It's a green card. You can use it or not use it. But you don't realize that with that gift comes the tax obligations with it.
Here's another question, though. What if they decided just not to return to the U.S. and let their green card lapse? In order to maintain your green card as your primary residence, you have to keep coming back within every 6 months.
6 months.
And there are a number of investors out there, a number of clients that who just didn't bother returning. And it's been 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and they haven't been back to the US. So technically, their green cards have lapsed. Do they still have to go through the process?
Absolutely. And this is actually funny. I'm not picking on you and your fellow brethren in the UK, but you went from one prime minister who was a citizen and got nabbed in Boris Johnson to old Rishi, who's a green card holder. And he learned the hard way. And Rishi is not living in the US and hasn't been. And he learned the hard way what happened to Boris in the press. And he came out and quickly said, oh, don't you worry, I'm keeping up on my tax filing obligations on my green card. So to answer your question specifically, there is a difference between immigration law and tax law. When someone calls or emails me and says, oh, don't worry, I read in the INA, the Immigration and Nationality Act, that I did this and I'm no longer American, or my green card expires after 6 months, I go, that's wonderful. But the INA doesn't send tax bills. The immigration office doesn't send notices. They don't have the ability to put a lien on assets. The IRS does. And if you look under 877-CAP-AG4 of the Internal Revenue Code, they're very clear. Just because a green card expires doesn't mean you're not taxed. Just because they take it at the border doesn't mean you properly gave it up. You need to renew a piece of plastic. I always tell clients, just because your UK passport, in your example, Mona, expired, does that mean you're not British anymore? No.
Good point.
It means you need to renew a piece of plastic.
Yeah. So here's another question for you. I know renunciation is a lengthy process and it involves extensive paperwork. And there are some charlatan lawyers out there who are trying to do it for a lot less than someone like Moody's would charge. What could go wrong if your paperwork isn't done correctly?
Yeah, it's a really good question. When someone goes in to renounce or give up citizenship, there are multiple jurisdictional areas to be mindful of: tax, immigration, Social Security, Foreign Affairs, State Department, USCIS, Homeland Security. With these pitfalls, it's not as easy as just saying, hey, I don't want to be American, here's the passport. I wish they made it that easy, but they don't. If you don't renounce the right way, you can get hit with a devastating exit tax, which is a tax on everything you own in the world, a deemed disposition. What's a deemed disposition? A deemed disposition is a pretend sale, but you didn't actually sell it, but they want their money. So if you renounce the right way to avoid the exit tax, which is what we help more clients than any firm in the world do, you are an expatriate. Think of an expatriate as someone who renounces, it was an amicable divorce, you take the dog, I'll take the cat, it's been fun.
Yeah, that analogy is helpful, and I can definitely see the downside now.
If you screw up a renunciation and you're a covered expat, which means you violate some of the rules of renouncing, a net worth test, a tax liability test, a compliance test, then you're hit with the exit tax and you owe Uncle Sam what can often be a very large dollar amount to leave the club. It's an expensive divorce in that example. And to boot, that covered expatriate status follows you for the rest of your life and can have devastating effects if you have U.S. citizen family members or children. So the goal, just on the tax side, we got to renounce the right way and avoid the exit tax. Then on top of that, there's an interview. And the interview exists to make sure you're of sound mind, no one's pressuring you, and to determine if you're doing this for tax avoidance purposes. If you want to renounce your Canadian or British citizenship, they don't tax on citizenship. You can send them a letter and they'll let you leave. They don't have to give you health care. But when you want to give up a citizenship that taxes on said status, there's an interview between bulletproof glass sent to the U.S. Attorney General. And if they determine you're doing this to avoid tax, you're blacklisted from the U.S. for life on an inadmissible list with drug traffickers, sex traffickers, Nazis who have committed genocide. You can't make this stuff up. It's called the Reed Amendment.
Yeah, that's severe. On the same vein, what about people who say they decide they want to leave the U.S. and give up citizenship on emotional grounds? Perhaps it's gun violence. Perhaps it's they don't like who comes in to office in November.
Haven't heard that before.
What can they still come back to the U.S.? Can they, you know, visit family? Or can they say they decide to come back to the U.S. and become a citizen again later? Are they barred from ever coming back?
Great question. And Mona, if we do a renunciation the right way, you will be treated like any other citizen of your fallback passport. So we'll avoid the landmines along the way over a 4 to 8 month process to come out on the other end. And in your example, if it were you, to be treated just like any other Brit. Well, what does that mean? What does it mean to be treated like any other Brit or Canadian or Aussie or Kiwi or Italian? It means we're going to avoid the exit tax. It means we're going to not be disbarred. We're not going to lose our benefits like Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare. In fact, you can get rid of all the bad tax and still collect Social Security. We make sure that when you travel back to the U.S., especially those who use their fallback passport, but it has a U.S. place of birth on an ESTA visa or another status, that they don't get harassed at the border, to the point where if the renunciation is done properly and all the tax filings are in order and the interview goes well and the paperwork is done and we come out and navigate those landmines on the other end looking like any other Brit, you can go back whenever you want, like all your other brethren, just like Boris Johnson, and spend 4, 5, 6 months a year there. I could even make you an American again. Just like any other Brit, I could get you a work permit, a visa, into a green card, into your citizenship back, assuming you do not have a felony record, which I know you don't.
Oh, very interesting. Well, again, when I was researching, I came across a survey from, I believe it's Greenback Expat Tax Services, and they polled something like 4,000 American expats. But these were expats living in 121 countries. And there was all these kind of issues which came up. One of the questions which came up is, you know, should they lobby? Is it possible, and I would love your opinion on this, that there might be new tax changes that would just make it a little easier for expats?
I often tell expats, because they ask me, this is funny you mentioned, we see record numbers of renunciations often in election years. And whether it be for, as you mentioned earlier, for political reasons, but a lot of times you'll see changes in tax law when new administrations come in and out. And people say, Alex, my politics aside, as an expat, should I be voting red or blue to help my tax situation? Who's going to help the expat? Is it Republicans or Democrats? And I jokingly tell them, you're looking for a third party who doesn't like free money from people who don't vote them back in when they're $40 trillion in debt. The joke that is these groups online, they often, in the FATCA challenges going all the way up to the Supreme Court here in Canada, which was smacked down before they even could hear it, to often, I won't name names, but groups online saying, donate here, we'll fight the good fight. You're never going to win. You need 218 members of the House, at least 51 senators, probably 60 to get filibuster proof, and a president who wants to commit political suicide and say, you know what? It's not fair that Boris Johnson, getting all the same rights, privileges, and immunities, sold his 3 million pound house and shouldn't have to pay a dime. But you, taxpayer in the swing state of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, you'll pick up the tab for them. And don't forget, inflation's at 8%. We're $40 trillion in the hole, and people are struggling to survive as it is. Be sure to vote for me in November.
Yeah. Well, that really does answer the question, yep. Right, Mark?
Yep, that's a hard sell.
It's a tough sell. It's a tough sell. There was one, years ago, there was one congressman out of North Carolina who a certain group duped him in to his own peril to try to put this before the floor, to try to do away with citizen-based taxation. And out of 435 members of the House, he got zero to join him.
Yeah. You're a U.S. citizen, Alex, but you live in Canada.
I do. I often tell my clients, you know, like I said, we've helped renounce over 54 going on 5,500 people, which is probably 5,200, 5,300 more than anybody in the world. And I always tell them, I feel in your pain. I'm a U.S. citizen living here in Alberta. You know, I have an interest in privately held corporations and in a law firm here. And as I tell people, I know how to work the system, and I still pay through the nose. And this is why so many people are renouncing, because if there was a better option, which was, hey, they're not going to catch me, which they will under FATCA, and Joe Biden just gave them, you had Obama who passed FATCA to catch you, which is the most diabolical system that the world has ever known. All other first world countries copied it in CRS. Then you had Trump come in with U.S. tax reform for the first 31 years. Previous reform was 87. He did it in 2017. He threw the expat under the bus. And now you've got Joe Biden, who just passed a bill last summer giving the IRS $80 billion more dollars and 87,000 more IRS agents to help find money abroad.
Wow. Well, just for our listener, FATCA stands for Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, I believe.
Right.
And you said that IRS track Americans, but I do believe, and you can correct me, that the FBI also track Americans who renounce.
Well, yeah, when you renounce citizenship. So there's a few issues here. The FATCA program is a snitching program. It's a way to find, they didn't have jurisdictional authority to go through the 190 plus countries agreed to this, because whether you love or hate Barack Obama, diabolically successful in its implementation.
Yeah.
Dear countries of the world, all of your banks are going to spend hundreds of billions of dollars a year to find our citizens, to turn them over to us. We don't pay a dollar and we collect billions in checks just sitting on the lounge chair. Not a bad program. The reason they all agreed to it, because if you didn't dance, and the only countries who didn't dance were North Korea, Iran, Cuba, I wouldn't put my money there, even China and Russia signed on to FATCA, you were locked out of the U.S. financial markets. It was, in essence, death blow sanctions. So that was passed, and the FATCA is the way to find them. Once you renounce and you get rid of that, you no longer are reportable to your bank. You can actually bank like a human being in Europe or Asia when they see born in Georgia and they won't do business with you because of the U.S. place of birth. That is when the renunciation process goes to the U.S. Attorney General, who then notifies FBI, Social Security, USCIS, Homeland Security. So that's why making sure all your ducks are in a row, both from your financial well-being and your interactions with the United States after, are critical. Because if you run afoul, these are life-altering consequences.
Wow, Alex, this is all great information. But just from 1,000 feet, could you just give our audience a little bit of an understanding as to what the costs are for renunciation and how long it takes?
Yeah, so I always tell clients, emotion aside, when you're renouncing, for most clients, we're not in the business of spending a dollar to save a quarter. So when we look at the cost to go through it, we also have to make sure that the savings, $2,350 US is what the government charges you on the day of the interview at that consulate to process your paperwork in DC. Our fee to help someone go through this process in legal fees can range anywhere. Your average client is usually 10 to 15 grand. If they haven't been filing their U.S. tax returns, so they're an expat living abroad, we need to go into an amnesty program, get full abatement of those penalties. We got to go back 5 years. You can spend another 10, 15 grand there. I tell people we can blink and spend 25 grand to solve this problem.
I'm sure a common concern that people would ask is, would they save more than they spend, right?
Assuming emotion is outside of this decision and it is a business decision, we're going to spend 25 grand to get compliant and renounce, or half of that if you're already compliant and just want to renounce. And then we're not going to have to file for the next 50 years. We won't owe hundreds of thousands on the sale of our home. If we're moving to a low tax jurisdiction, our crypto, our investments are going to be tax-free for the rest of our life. No estate tax. So the economics of it need to make sense. It just so happens in 99.9% of cases, whether you're low, middle, or high income, it'll make economic sense outside of emotion. Now, how quickly we can renounce, we have wait times to renounce that are insane. Here in Canada, at its peak, for the privilege of renouncing and spending all that money, and in air quotes, I say privilege, our wait times at 5 consulates and embassies at one point were hitting 2.5 to 3 year wait times. Now they've gotten better. They're down to about 1.5 to 2 years. And we've seen this in Sydney, in Bern, in London. Now we have places where we'll forum shop and we can renounce someone at a different consulate or embassy, and it can be solved in as quick as 3 to 5 months. But the demand is unbelievable.
Mark, didn't I tell you he knew his stuff?
Yes, you did, Mona. You certainly did. And now I see why. I mean, for me, you know, born in the U.S. and also served in the U.S. military, it's not something I would think about. But also, you know, with the freedom of us being human beings and the freedom that we should have to live across the world, it doesn't really make sense to get double taxed. And now I can see why someone would want to go down this route and the huge value there is if that meets your needs.
Yeah, I agree. Alex, you have to come back and give us more information. There's wonderful, wonderful information that you have on taxes and renunciation issues, etc.
Oh, no, absolutely. It would be my pleasure. And thanks again, Mark and Mona, for having me.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshahlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.